to Day On Against the Grain. You may have heard of musicology and maybe ethnomusicology, but what is ecomusicology? I'm CS. Aaron Allen describes what ecomusicology is and does, and we also hear from Martin Daughtry about the sonic dimension of warfare coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. A year ago, the musicologist Aaron Allen joined this program to talk about a range of issues, including anthropocentrism, ecocentrism, and the difference between strong and weak forms of sustainability. I asked Aaron at the time if he'd join us again to define and describe his specialty, which is ecomusicology. What does that term mean, and what do ecomusicologists investigate? This time, we asked Aaron Allen to prepare a talk, which we are pleased to present today. Later this hour, you'll hear from another music and sound studies scholar. Martin Daughtry talks about his research into the sonic dimension, the auditory element of warfare. We begin with Aaron Allen, Associate Professor of Musicology and Director of the Environment and Sustainability Program at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. He co-edited the volume Current Directions in Ecomusicology, Music, Culture, Nature. Here is Aaron's talk.
My remarks are organized in three parts. First, I'll begin with the various ways to understand the interdisciplinary field of ecomusicology in the plural, as ecomusicologies. Second, I'll provide three brief case studies. And finally, I'll provide a few critiques of what I've termed global ecomusicologies. To begin, it's probably best to respond to the question I imagine many will have. What is ecomusicology? The Standard Music Reference Encyclopedia says that ecomusicology is the study of music, culture, and nature in all the complexities of those terms. Nature and culture are two of the most complex words in the English language, and for anyone who's studied the great diversity of sonic traditions and the variety of human responses to them, music also deserves to be counted in this category of complex keywords. As the study of music and culture and nature, ecomusicology attempts to harness a kaleidoscopic complexity of intellectual and artistic inquiries. As a result, we end up needing to understand ecomusicology in the plural, as ecomusicologies. That encyclopedia definition was productively expanded when ecomusicological pioneer Jeff Titan added that ecomusicology has come about during a period of environmental crisis. Jeff pinpointed ecomusicology's development during the time environmental crises have become increasingly apparent. These crises include the staggering loss of biodiversity that puts us in a mass extinction event of our own making. These crises include the wrapping of our planet in plastic and the concomitant injection of large amounts of chemicals into all living bodies, resulting in an unethical, uncontrolled, and unplanned toxicology experiment on an epical scale. And of course, there's the climate crisis, also known as global heating, in which the effluent of the industrial technology that makes possible our present encounter is increasing Earth's atmospheric carbon and altering life as we know it. The results are profound weather imbalances, environmental catastrophes, and injustices everywhere. Tragically, these problems impact the weakest and most unfortunate people first and worst. It's important to point out that environmental crises are human crises, and those who suffer most are usually the ones who have not caused the problems yet have already suffered so much. Thus, environmental crises are also prolonged crises of human injustices. Rather than talk about this context of crises, I just want to point out that ecomusicology is a direct result of them. Ecomusicology exists because we care about both sound and life on a planet that we're steadily making uninhabitable. I've traced the term ecomusicology to the 1970s, and despite a minor resurgence in the 90s, it wasn't really widespread until the second decade of the 21st century. After the first International Ecomusicologies Conference in 2012, Kevin Daw and I co-authored Current Directions in Ecomusicology, which was the first book to map the field. 21 scholars contributed 19 chapters organized into four directions: ecological, fieldwork, critical, and textual. By textual, I mean all sorts of texts, from poetry and newspaper writings to novels, musical scores, and electronic recordings. All the authors took the approach of connecting music, culture, and nature in various ways. But given the group we assembled, there were trends that followed from the two major scholarly fields of music cultural study. Ethnomusicologists tend to use more natural sciences and fieldwork approaches, while musicologists tend to use more literary and historical methods. In our introductory chapter, Kevin and I wanted to make it very clear that ecomusicology is not a discipline. Rather, it's an interdisciplinary field that connects many different disciplines. We described ecomusicology as the coming together of music and sound studies with environmental and ecological studies and sciences. These areas essentially interface with all the human and non-human systems on planet Earth, making them enormously broad in scope and subject. So, due to such a significant planetary scale, due to the important context of human and environmental crises, and due to our complex keywords of music, culture, and nature, we propose the field as a multiplicity, as ecomusicologies. To understand it a bit more, let's consider its etymology. The word ecomusicology is a combination of ecocriticism and musicology. The field of environmental literary studies, known as ecocriticism, has had formative influences on ecomusicology. Ecocriticism connects ecology and criticism, while musicology connects music and logos, this last of which is Latin for both word and the study of. Logos is also an etymological part of the word ecology, which stems from the Greek oikos, meaning house or environment. So, taken together, we could understand ecomusicology as the critical study of music and environment. In this etymological approach, we end up with a simple two-part understanding: music and environment. This is a relatively inclusive, if dualistic, framework of the field. Frameworks are conceptual structures for understanding ideas. We can also think of them as theoretical frameworks, or simply as theories. A broad and inclusive framework for ecomusicology is one that connects human sound worlds and non-human sound worlds. While I find this useful as a starting point for understanding ecomusicology, I must point out that it relies on a problematic binary opposition between the human and non-human that can adversely impact the flourishing of life on Earth. Humans and non-humans, culture and nature, people and the Earth, all are inherently connected, and we should not undermine such relationships by binarizing them. Another framework, then, may be helpful for understanding ecomusicology in relation to the established disciplines of musicology and ethnomusicology. This framework is the three-way connection between music, culture, and nature. There are other keywords that can be easily substituted here, such as sound for music, society for culture, environment for nature. The specific terms are less important than the ideas and their connections. We can break down this three-part framework to understand its parts in relation to a few common disciplines. The study of human culture and society is often concentrated in disciplines such as anthropology and sociology. Sometimes we might consider these as anthropocentric, because they focus exclusively on humans. The study of nature and environment is usually found most purely in scientific disciplines such as physics, chemistry, and biology. Sometimes we might consider these as non-anthropocentric because they usually don't focus on humans. We might consider them instead to be more biocentric or ecocentric, that is, more focused on the totality of life and ecological systems. The study of music and sound is usually classified as humanistic, meaning we focus on the human world and its sounds. In essence, music and sound studies are also anthropocentric. In fact, we often double down on this anthropocentric approach by allying our study of music and sound with disciplines that study culture and society, such as anthropology and history. The study of music and sound is extremely diverse, ranging from the physics and technology of sound to the philosophy and art of music. We include performers who make sounds and music, listeners who engage with them, and scholars who study all of them. I myself am trained as a musicologist to consider historical, social, and cultural matters as they relate to music and sound. Others in our fields may be music theorists or ethnomusicologists, although such disciplinary distinctions are more pronounced in the U.S. than in academic fields in other countries. Regardless of the exceptions to these broad generalizations, the point that I'd like to make here is the following. While historical musicologists and ethnomusicologists study music and culture anthropocentrically, ecomusicologists take it a step further by studying music and culture as connected explicitly and critically with nature. Thus, ecomusicology is more ecocentric. Here's the central point of my remarks today, namely, the distinction of two terminological equations. Typical studies of musics and sounds connect with cultural or societal elements. That two-part equation is in the realms of ethnomusicology and musicology. The addition of nature and/or environment to that two-part study distinguishes them as ecomusicologies. Let me put this distinction another way, this time in the terminology of music. Musicology and ethnomusicology take a dyadic approach to music and culture, but ecomusicology is a triad that adds concern for the non-sounding, non-human, planetary contexts that make music and culture possible. To get more specific, I'd like to share three very brief examples. The literature is vast and I can't be comprehensive, but to show some diversity, I'd like to share one case study each from sound studies, ethnomusicology, and musicology. The first comes from soundscape studies, which aim to make explicit the patterns and changes in our sounding world. Soundscape artists and acoustic ecologists want to raise awareness about the state of the world as revealed through sound. Composer David Dunn goes beyond this environmental awareness to ecological remediation. Dunn's interest in nature is evident from his decades of artistic activity, and ecological research informs both his creative work and scientific scholarship. His collaboration with physicist James Crutchfield explains how bark beetles attack drought-stressed trees to reproduce and ultimately kill the trees. Here are the sounds from uninfected trees. And here are the beetle chirps. They're field recordings of the bioacoustic communication between the beetle and the tree call into question chemical-centric interpretations of the species by showing that beetles can detect the ultrasonic emissions of drought-stressed trees. Furthermore, sound can be used to counter the infestations, thus protecting the trees and interrupting the negative feedback cycle of deforestation.
That's Aaron Allen. He's a musicologist and ecological thinker based at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You're listening to a talk that Aaron prepared on the topic of ecomusicology. Let's return to more of that talk.
The second case study is an ecomusicological classic. Ethnomusicologist Steve Fell documented the connections between the indigenous Bosavi people and the endemic avian fauna and forest ecology in the central highland plateau of Papua New Guinea. In his anthropological and linguistic work, Feld recorded Kaluli language, stories, myths, behaviors, and songs. A particular subset of Kaluli songs relate to the Muni bird, which is central to Kaluli conceptions of sadness and mourning. By evoking its call in ritual and recreational singing, the Kaluli connect to the spirit world of birds in the forest. Kaluli music has a self-conscious aesthetic termed duluguganalan, or lift-up-over sounding, which is an in-sync but out-of-phase style that Kaluli say is in response to their sonic rainforest environment. In the following, two women sing a song in that style.
One in a way, one in a wo,
one in a wo,
one in a wo,
one in a wo.
Ninawa
Unfortunately, extractivism moved into Kalule lands. The mining company Freeport-McMoRan has clear-cut, strip-mined, and polluted Kalule waterways. Feld has protested these actions. In fact, he resigned from his tenured position at UT Austin over that institution's financial ties to Freeport. The government of Papua New Guinea even banned Feld from returning to the country. Adding insult to injury, Kalule ways were threatened by religious missionaries. Young Kalule no longer sing like the Muni or in Ndulugugunalan. They've adopted Western instruments and styles. Feld argues that as biodiversity goes extinct, so does human cultural and musical diversity. The third case study is based on my own musicological research. Fundamental to the sound of Western art music, the violin family forms the backbone of ensembles from chamber to stage. Professional violins depend on at least two endemic natural resources, Italian spruce for the soundboards and Brazilian Pernambuco for the bows. The highest quality bows are made of only wild-grown Pernambuco from Brazil's Atlantic coastal forest. Pau Brasil was so important that European colonial powers warred over it with each other and with indigenous peoples. Eventually, the country Brazil was named after the wood. Today, the forest is nearly extinct. A mere 8% of the original forest is extant, and only 5% of wild Pernambuco habitat remains. Thus, rarity and poaching threaten this unusual resource. Italian red spruce has fared better in the unusual alpine microclimate of the Val di Fiemme's Penaveggio forest. The species is widely distributed and not at all threatened, but it's Penaveggian spruce that makes excellent resonance wood for soundboards. Stradivari used this primary material, and his creations have contributed to the renown of the Penaveggio, known as the Forest of the Violins. Despite various threats during the past millennium, Fiemmese traditions have preserved the forest. Today, more trees grow than loggers harvest, and musicians regularly make pilgrimages to their sacred groves in the Penaveggio. Western art music contributes both to threatening and to protecting the unique resources on which it depends. In other words, our aesthetic choices have ethical ramifications that impact the world in tangibly good and bad ways. We certainly could make instruments out of recycled material or carbon fiber, but by and large, we've chosen to make them out of wood. Thus, music exists thanks to trees. The orchestra is basically a forest in the concert hall. Therefore, aesthetic choices impact people as well as the planet. Thinking about primary materials is one way to connect culture to nature through music. It's useful to understand and explain the infrastructures, supply chains, and ecosystems that provide for music cultures. The scholar Kyle Devine elaborated on this in his 2019 book, Decomposed, which traced the human and environmental costs of music technology. Even in our seemingly dematerialized, wireless, internet-enabled world, the climate and social costs of our music consumption are significantly higher than the days of shellac, vinyl, and plastic. We need to come to terms with these impacts and make changes to address them. Before getting to my concluding critiques, I'd like to recap briefly. I began with multiple definitions, an etymology, and frameworks for ecomusicology as an interdisciplinary field best understood in the plural. Then I provided three brief case studies, bark beetles and scientists in the American West, birds in the Kalule in Papua New Guinea, and musical forests in Brazil and Italy. If I had more time, I would have provided a review of the literature to map the many places in the world where ecomusicologists work and where ecomusicology is happening. Doing so would show the plurality and diffusion of ecomusicology around the world, hence global ecomusicologies. But there's another meaning of global, namely one that connects with the eco prefix to emphasize a more environmental, more earth-centered form of music and sound studies, one that moves away from anthropocentrism and towards a greater ecocentrism. So, global ecomusicologies are concerned with ecocentrism and the earth and are relevant the world over. Mapping all these places would show that plurality, emphasis, and diffusion. Yet it would also show extraordinary differences, inequities, and gaps. While there may be representation from all the populated continents, there's a decided concentration of ecomusicologists in North America and Western Europe. This brings me to my three critiques of ecomusicology, each of which has a flip side. My first problem with the field of ecomusicology is the imbalanced representation of place, which mapping shows is concentrated in the West. This imbalance could be addressed by doing more research in and about other places, but doing so risks a colonizing, extractivist approach that's been the cause of so many intertwined social and environmental problems. Should Western scholars go elsewhere to study interesting ecomusicological issues and write about them for our professional benefits? The discipline of anthropology has faced this challenge, and I would hate to see it afflict ecomusicologies. Such a risk of colonial extractivism is related to my second critique, namely, that ecomusicologists are primarily academics in the Western university mold. On the one hand, these people comprise international intellectual networks that can share and disseminate ideas, resources, and approaches relatively effectively. On the other hand, such networks can produce a homogenizing approach that tamps down the flourishing of a diversity of approaches. So even accessible and inclusive approaches can end up causing problems. My third and most complex critique relates to the ideas included in the products of ecomusicology. On the one hand, most of these products involve the capacity for sharing, such as articles, books, films, and obviously experiences and recordings of music and sound. In some cases, we may not be able to distribute them all across time and space, but that doesn't preclude our having empathetic relations that are shared, spread, and carried forward. On the other hand, the academic products of ecomusicology face a number of intellectual challenges. I'll address three of these briefly and elaborate on a fourth. My aim is to provide a warning of what I hope global ecomusicologies can avoid. First, I worry about weak understandings of sustainability that amount to little more than greenwashing, by which I mean feel-good marketing tactics that literally keep individuals and systems unchanged. The term sustainability is often nothing more than a buzzword, and ecomusicologists should beware when using it in uncritical ways that simply mean to maintain. Rather, sustainability must be about changing the way human civilization operates on Earth. Second, the nature-culture binary characterizes much of Western civilization. It's a pernicious duality that understands humans as separate from nature, and it creeps into our thinking way too often. Calling for a greater connection with nature is important, but ecomusicologists must understand that some humans have been equated as more natural than others, with the result that they've become subject to exploitation because a dominant class believed them to be lesser than human. These are complex power dynamics to negotiate. Third, the Anthropocene is a subject that music scholars have only recently grappled with. The concept itself is problematically, well, anthropocentric. It gives credit to humanity for having fundamentally damaged our planet's biosphere, and it therefore calls on humanity to step up and take collective action to fix what's been done. At the same time that Homo sapiens is without question responsible for damaging the biosphere, it's also without question that not all of us have done so equally. A small cadre of now privileged individuals have benefited immensely from the exploitations that cause the climate crisis, pollute every inch of the earth, and decimate its biodiversity. Some of us have come along for the ride, gladly or unknowingly, or even offering significant resistance. But the vast majority of humanity has played no role in the destruction of the planet, and therefore should shoulder no guilt to protect it. Fourth, the most problematic idea for me is environmentalism. As I'll explain in just a moment, it's troublesome because of its past, but I also find it troublesome because I identify as an environmentalist. To be clear, I'm not suggesting that we abandon these problematic ideas. Ultimately, I hope that diverse, inclusive, aware global ecomusicologies will engage them in order to understand their potential possibilities and pitfalls. It's necessary to take self-reflective and critical stances and to engage with problematic ideas such as these. And environmentalism sure is problematic. The late 19th and early 20th century origins of American environmentalism are racist, colonialist, nationalist, and elitist. These problems continue in various ways into the present, both in mainstream environmental organizations and in fringe movements such as ecofascism. Popularization of environmentalism in the 1960s and 70s saw it emerge as a force within Western neoliberalism, which has emphasized free market, individualized, and non-governmental approaches. Neoliberal environmentalism has both hidden and institutionalized some of the ugly features of early American environmentalism as it's been exported around the world. But there are other ways than Western environmentalism to understand planetary challenges and to diversify the anthropocentric humanities and social sciences as we seek to address our environmental crises. The globalization of American-style environmentalism is problematic, not just for its fascist or neoliberal elements, but primarily because of its contradictions. In other words, Westerners are the ones who have the most significant environmental impacts, yet talk most about saving nature. We do that particularly through our excessive use of globalized natural resources, international conservation initiatives, consumptive tourism, and scientific research extractivism. Given ecomusicology's direct ties with concern for the environment, which may be equated with environmentalism, my concern is that ecomusicology might be used or understood inadvertently or explicitly in the same exploitative ways as American-style environmentalism. Westernized global environmentalism is not a model for ecomusicology. Instead, there must be a better equation that connects people to each other justly and to the planet ecologically. This is where diverse environmentalisms step in. There's been a movement to build bridges between northern and southern framings of environmental problems, and this has involved a greater understanding of diverse environmentalisms. Offering a counter to global environmentalism, diverse environmentalisms aim to protect people and ecosystems using variegated strategies that eschew problematic ideas of wilderness and neoliberalism. We need diverse ecomusicologies to counter the troublesome histories of Western environmentalism. This approach is evident, for example, in the ecomusicological work of the Diverse Environmentalisms Research Team, led by Rebecca Dirksen at Indiana University. My hope is that global ecomusicologies will learn from diverse environmentalisms and not end up as a problematic Western export. Global ecomusicologies must be truly plural, inclusive, and diverse, earth-centered and humanistic, and multi-perspectival and interdisciplinary. Global ecomusicologies must not be disciplinary or even exist within any single discipline. Rather, ecomusicology must be an integrative field that is radically diverse. We must do more to amplify those doing this type of work, even if it's not what we would do ourselves. In that way, we share different ways of working on divergent yet connected issues, so we can come together around difference in order to make a difference.
Aaron S. Allen, Associate Professor of Musicology at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. For more information and details, go to againstthegrain.org and click on the link we've provided to a keynote lecture Aaron delivered in Turkey last June. What you just heard was adapted from that talk. You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. We turn now to examine sound in a very different context, warfare. Martin Daughtry is Associate Professor of Music and Sound Studies at New York University. He's the author of Listening to War, Sound, Music, Trauma, and Survival in Wartime Iraq. I spoke with Martin in 2015 about an article he wrote regarding acoustic violence and the sonic dimension of warfare. His piece appeared in the journal Social Text. When Martin Daughtry joined me, he told me that in 2006, while living in Washington, D.C., he became a regular donor of blood platelets at Walter Reed Hospital, the largest medical facility that treated amputees who were sent back from the combat zone in Iraq. As Martin had his blood drawn, he would get into informal conversations with U.S. military personnel about the music they listened to on their iPods while in Iraq.
They were happy to talk to me about music, but at some point in every conversation, the subject would veer off into a consideration of how loud it is in the combat zone and how difficult it is actually to listen to music, because people are in Humvees that are generating 95 decibels of white noise, engine sounds. People have headphones on that are shooting communications from multiple networks into their ears. And all the time, in this very loud, kind of layered environment, what they were listening for was the soft sounds of bullets ricocheting off the exterior of their vehicles, because it was only the sound of weaponry that let them know that a battle had commenced, that action was taking place. There was kind of an overwhelmingly auditory thing. So I found I was fascinated by how sophisticated their listening skills were, right? How they managed to hone skills that allowed them to listen through lots and lots of layers of noise and other sounds that were not giving them information about what was going on around them, and kind of ferret out these soft sounds that you or I, had we been in the same position, might never have heard. And one, my first kind of discovery was that sound in that circumstance is a dual-edged sword, right? It's a profound source of information for people who have developed the listening skills necessary to decode sound. But at the same time, those sounds that were so informationally rich were traumatizing civilians and service members alike, right? Hearing loss and tinnitus were the number two and number one injuries among American military service members in the Iraq War.
So what you're saying is that not just the military service members you talked to, but the civilians on the ground, the people who were in the midst of this conflict, they developed very sophisticated listening skills in relation to the sounds of wartime.
Similarly sophisticated listening skills, that's right. Iraqi civilians who, when battles took place, often placed themselves in windowless areas of their house, you know, to avoid shrapnel or shattered glass, were still exposed to sounds, right? To the sounds of Kalashnikov fire on their streets. And they were able to, over time, in dialogue with one another, map acoustic events onto their knowledge of the neighborhood. So if you heard automatic gunfire coming from a particular direction and you knew that there was a Mahdi army outpost, you know, in that direction, you could surmise that that fighting group was engaging with another fighting group. And they managed to, you know, they could tell things about the caliber of a bullet or the identity of a firearm based solely on the sounds that that firearm made. So they could, everyone, Iraqis and Americans, could tell the difference between an M4 and an AK-47. So putting those pieces together and mapping them onto what they knew about the neighborhood, they could say, okay, there's a forward operating base over here, and they're, you know, they're exchanging fire with a Sunni group over here, and now you can tell that the Sunnis have the upper hand, and, you know, the battle is concluding, and, you know, in fact, we've had six battles like that over the past week.
So we've been talking, Martin, about sounds at the level of interpretability. In other words, these people are hearing sounds and they can kind of try and make sense of them to, of course, varying degrees depending on their experience, their prior experience with some of these sounds. What about sounds of explosion and other sounds that are just so loud that they kind of overwhelm the senses? What do we need to understand about the level to which they can be understood or made meaning of, and the degree to which something else happens in the mind of the person hearing it?
That's a great question. I think normally when we are thinking about listening as an activity, we're all pretty comfortable understanding that people listen to music differently, right? That if I study Bach for years and years and years, and you don't, and we both listen to the same piece, I'm going to get something out of it that you might not, right? It doesn't mean that you'll get nothing, but that I will have developed skills as a listener of Bach. It's less intuitive proposition to say that people listen not just to music, but to the world that way. that ambient sound out and around in the city is something that we learn to listen to. I think the kind of default conventional assumption is that it's just there, right? That the traffic noise is there, and you know that all of the bird sound and everything, that we don't need to really learn how to listen to it. It's just kind of washing over us. So one of the contentions that a lot of contemporary sound studies scholarship makes is to show how culture is present in the act of listening, and it's present pretty constantly. Now, what I found in the extreme situation of protracted armed violence like what we witnessed in the Iraq War, that culture at a certain point kind of ceases to matter, that when sounds become so powerful that they, you know, can concuss us or knock us out or deafen us, that at the moment of experience, people no longer have recourse to culture as kind of a standing resource that allows us to make sense of the world. So I became interested in those kind of extreme experiences. And I ended up writing the article as a kind of a response to the contention that culture is extremely powerful in kind of teaching people how to listen, and that people listen in very culturally specific ways. I think that is often true, maybe most of the time, but that when you are the, you know, survivor of a near IED explosion that knocks you unconscious and causes permanent tinnitus and hearing loss, at the moment of that explosion, culture has receded into the distance.
Now, you said sounds can concuss us. And of course, sound is compression waves moving through a medium such as air. So are you saying that extremely loud sounds can literally compress or batter a human body?
Yeah, here's what happens. When an explosion takes place, it generates a blast wave. And that blast wave is a really sharp kind of high pressure front that moves initially faster than sound. But over time, that blast wave, that differential in pressure, as it moves, it slows down and it regularizes itself. And it's that blast wave that becomes the low rumbling sound that, you know, if you're close by, returns to you as echo, right? It becomes the sound of the explosion over time for those people who have the luxury of distance. So if you're far enough away, you hear and probably also feel that wave. But if you are too close, you don't hear it. You experience it as blunt force. And there are a number of clinicians who work with traumatic brain injury, which is one of the signature injuries of the Iraq War, who claim that that very blast wave that becomes a sound a little bit later can jiggle your brain kind of inside its casing, inside your skull, bruising it and causing the traumatic brain injury, which you know, then, as we're seeing in America, is creating a generation of problems that have no real cure. There's no technique for healing traumatic brain injury. It's something that is there that one has to contend with. So there is a sense in which traumatic brain injury is a sound wound, right? Because it's created by that same blast wave in the milliseconds before it becomes a sound.
And here I think we get to one of the main points of your research, which is, and maybe a way to lead up to this, is to say that we often think of violent acts or violent events as being accompanied by a sound, as being associated with a sound. You're suggesting, I think, a more direct relationship between sound and violence.
Yeah. I think there are many, many, many instances in which sound functions as an index of violence, right? Sound is the thing that points to a violent act having taken place. But there are also instances where, when sounds become particularly intense in terms of their volume, where sound kind of moves past that moment of indexicality and becomes a manifestation of violence itself. And warfare is, you know, one of these situations in which those moments where sound can wound, both physically in terms of traumatic brain injury, as I mentioned, hearing loss, you know, and those kind of things, but also psychologically, those are experiences that are lamentably common.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You are listening to portions of an interview I conducted with Martin Daughtry, Associate Professor of Music and Sound Studies at New York University. We return to more of Martin's commentary.
One of the things that is pretty ubiquitous in wartime combat situations is that people go way out of their way not to see constantly. Military doctrine and civilian life ways both necessitate that when you look tactically, right? You poke your head up and look over a barrier or through a window, and then you, having quickly assessed the situation, you retreat, because to see is to be seen, you know, at least potentially. And to be seen is to put yourself out as a potential target or victim. So people, you know, people understand this. So they're snatching these little glances. They're looking very sporadically, but all the while their ears are exposed to sound, which, you know, unlike sight, kind of moves around corners very well, right? So they're always listening, and they're always subject to these strange and often troubling and exhausting, when they happen over and over and over again, emotional rides through guilt, exhilaration, despair, fear, aggression.
Now, sound also, and you make repeated reference to this in your writings, sound can also persist in memory. It can trigger things long after the sound has died away. Can you talk about this aspect of sound as you heard from Iraqi civilians who survived the Iraq War and also U.S. military personnel who served in Iraq?
Sure. Sound is one of the recognized triggers for post-traumatic stress disorder. Because of sort of ethical rules of the university, I kind of went out of my way not to talk to people who had been clinically diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. I didn't feel like I was qualified to do that. So all of the people that I spoke with are people who had experiences that were very, very widespread during the Iraq War. And very many of the people with whom I spoke would say to me, now, I don't have PTSD. I don't have post-traumatic stress disorder. But when I returned home from Iraq and I heard slamming doors or fireworks or the low boom of a construction site or any number of other sounds, I absolutely panicked, or I had a flashback and felt like I was back in theater, or I took cover, or I had this sinking feeling. I still get this sinking feeling when I hear the low boom from a construction site, you know, the feeling of where you're wondering who got hurt. So one of the things that I tried to kind of evoke in this article is the way in which sound can kind of infiltrate your memory. Sound, a particular kind of sound, right? Sound that has been fused with a violent act. The way that that kind of sound can worm its way into your memory and kind of loop itself and keep your embodied memory of what it was like to experience violence very fresh and immediate in your mind. So it turns out, you know, we talked earlier about these extreme sounds that kind of damage your body. A sound doesn't have to be extremely loud in order to have a disturbing psychological effect on you. A sound doesn't have to be loud at all in order to trigger, you know, an episode of post-traumatic stress. In fact, one of the kind of perversities, I think, of the sonic dimension of violence is that those kind of sounds end up ventriloquizing all of these very common sounds in our civilian lives. When I spoke to one retired service member who said that, you know, he was driving down the highway in the United States and he heard a car accelerating in the fast lane from behind. He could hear a car getting ready to pass him. And it was that sound, it was the sound of a car accelerating from behind you that provoked an episode, a flashback for him, because that is how vehicular-borne IED attacks began. A vehicular-borne IED attack begins when you hear a car, a vehicle accelerating from behind you just before it detonates. So a sound as anodyne and as common and mundane as a car on the street can victimize you, that's a moment in which that sound is enacting a kind of violence upon you, right? And it's not even the sound that took place in Iraq. It's just a sound that happens to bear some sort of similar characteristics to it.
So, Martin, your analysis of sound focuses a great deal on the cacophony of battle. Does this mean you are less interested in the broader structural forces that enable and promote wartime violence?
No, it does not mean that. I think my contribution, my modest contribution that I'm trying to make is to show that the embodied experience of violence is relevant, is something that we need to take into account, even though, it seems like something that is just restricted to individuals. What does it mean to be a victim of violence? And who is the victim of violence? If we think of, let's just take, the most simple situation, a bullet being fired from a gun, right? A bullet is this tiny little, 9-millimeter projectile that moves in a straight line through time and space. And it seems like, I think conventionally we think of violence, if violence exists anywhere, it's riding on top of that bullet. And so violence is directed at the person who gets shot. That's a conventional way to think about armed violence. So if I shoot you, the violent act moves unidirectionally from my gun into your body. What I would like to argue is that violence moves through the world in a way that is simultaneously directional and omnidirectional. It goes in all directions. So let's take a kind of a sonic situation, and that is shooter's ear. When you are shooting, if you're shooting a rifle and you're right-handed, your right ear is protected a little bit by the acoustic shadow that your head provides and by the fact that it's close to your shoulder. But your left ear is closer to the muzzle of the weapon and more exposed. So shooter's ear is a very common phenomenon, and it involves like hearing loss in your left ear, in that ear that is exposed. When someone engages in an act of armed violence, the projectile moves in one direction, but the sonic evidence of the projectile, the report of the weapon, moves out in all directions at the same time. That's just one of the properties of sound. And if you are exposed to sounds that you know to be connected intimately to acts of extreme violence, and you're exposed to those sounds day in and day out, you're not victimized in the same way that the person who receives the bullet is victimized, but you are harmed. You are harmed by exposure to that sound. You're harmed literally, corporeally by having your hearing degraded, but you're also harmed psychologically. And so I would like, if we think about the incident of shooter's ear as a directed act of violence that has this kind of leakage effect that brings a secondary violence back onto me, the perpetrator, back onto me, the shooter. That, I think, is the way that violence moves through the world. A violent act through sound, but also more broadly, degrades everyone who is within what Rancière calls the field of the sensible. And I think that's really important. I think in order to understand why violence is such a persistent, intractable phenomenon, we have to acknowledge that that it moves through the world omnidirectionally and it degrades the capacity and humanity of the primary victim, bystanders, and even the person who is responsible for the act of violence.
How, in the light of what you've been arguing, do you interpret and evaluate concepts like smart bombs and smart weapons, concepts that are often propagated by the military?
Well, if we decide that the sonic dimension of violence is important and that sound can be not just an index of or a sign of, but actually an agent of violence or a manifestation of violence, then all of this sanitizing language that we have about smart weaponry and surgical attacks and precision, all of the kind of language that we have developed in order to naturalize and hide violence, all of that is kind of revealed as what it is, as a kind of obfuscation, right? A smart bomb is as loud as a dumb, you know, as a regular bomb. Or even if it's not quite as loud, it's still profoundly, you know, loud and its sound travels. So if that sound traveling around creates a vast, expansive field of people who are victims to that act, victims by being forced to witness it through their ears, then that attack is anything but surgical.
Martin Daughtry, a music and sound studies scholar based at NYU. Martin is the author of Listening to War, Sound, Music, Trauma, and Survival in Wartime Iraq. And that wraps up this edition of Against the Grain. I'm CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.